Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a second episode in a row with 99-year-old Jim Kunkel of Santa Ynez, California, a recipient of the Distinguished Service Cross, not to mention the Purple Heart, for the incredible mission he survived in his P-38 over Aachen, Germany back in September 1944. And if people were listening, they heard you say, you know, your plane was on fire, and the next thing you knew, you were plummeting toward the earth. So you don't know how exactly you got out of that P-38?
I don't know. You know, the P-38, we actually had roll-up windows. You had a little crank like a car, and you'd roll your windows up on either side. Then they had a lock on them. And then your top hatch up here, you could pull that, and the top hatch would go. And that was your emergency exit. To this day, and I have thought about it many times, I don't recall reaching for that. I know that I lost my oxygen. I had my oxygen mask on, my helmet. They went at some point, so I didn't take them off. I don't remember releasing. You know, we didn't have any way of, you crawled out. You had to release your belt. I don't remember releasing my belt. I just remember that stack of fire coming out of that. Remember that? So I don't know. I don't know. I don't have any idea really how, and I don't particularly care. Maybe they can give you a shot and you remember. Let's just leave it alone.
Well, and one of the reasons I ask is because from what I've heard from guys who had to do it, the P-38 is one of the most tricky or dangerous planes to bail out of because, you know, a lot of guys would bail out and then get hit on the forked tail, or if they didn't do it quite right, they may not make it to the ground.
Well, that's true, but, you know, honestly, the 38, I never considered it any different than a Mustang or a B-47 because that stabilizer's in the same place. I've known a lot of people that went out of them. We had that dumb, like you look on the stabilizer of that model over there, you got those two weights. Kelly Johnson said that was a waste of good money putting those things on. And he ought to know. I've heard of guys getting tangled up with that. They didn't try to energetically get the hell out of that airplane. Sure, I know guys in Mustangs that didn't make it. B-47s that didn't. So I always thought the 38 was just as easy to get out of as any of it. Probably, I would guess that I know when this all started, I was in a pretty tight turn because I was pulling some heavy G's. We had what they call a combat flap. And up here on your flap lever, there's a little trigger. The combat flap, you just hit that flap handle, and it would stop and give you 20 degrees of combat flap, which was before the flaps actually start down into heavy drag. It increases your effective wing area. And you should never do it over 250 miles an hour. Well, I used it a couple times, and I was not even close to 250. I'm doing 350. You don't worry about that. I mean, I'd rather blow them off than get shot down. But I remember using flaps several times to tighten that turn. I know when I woke up in the hospital, the doctor who developed this system on burns, what they did is they keep the burn open. They take the scab off and they pick at you like that. I remember them picking on me and I thought I was going to go through the roof. But they used that same thing on Chuck Yeager when he bailed out of that 104, was that they used that same system. Well, I was one of the first, and every place I went after the aid station, they'd take me down to where all these young kids had been so badly burned in tankers and various accidents, and kind of tell them, well, you know, I was badly burned and I had this system and that we're using it on you. You should be fine. And it was just a good PR work.
Yeah, the idea was it minimized the scarring, and I'm looking at you, and I can't tell you ever went through that. But what you went through was pretty significant. You were in the hospital for how long?
Well, I was in the hospital, it happened in September. The end of November, I got out of the hospital in England and went back to the squadron, which was another story. I got out of England and I didn't have a uniform. My flight suit, they'd cut my good jacket off me. It was not a leather jacket, but one of the green ones we had. When they decided to send me to England, well, they gave me a GI uniform, and we'd laugh about it. You know, what they did when you uniform you're wearing, your shirt, your pants, and you go into the hospital, they take them off you. And if they don't cut them off, they send them down to the laundry and wash them and then give them out again. So I was laughing. I had some patched holes in mine. I said, well, this guy got shot here and probably in the butt. So anyway, when I left England, I had this uniform on, and I didn't have any insignia. I had a cap I'd found, and I didn't have any money. So I ended up in Paris, and I went to the Red Cross, got a room, still didn't have any money. Thought, well, I'll go see the town. So I go down to the Lido Club, the hot spot on the Champs-Élysées. It's still there. Everybody's having a good time. All of the ground-bound quartermaster guys are down there with their French girlfriends, and everybody's having a great time. I used to like to dance. I ended up dancing at the Lido Club. Didn't have enough money to buy a drink. In comes this group of guys. I look at them. They got all Class A uniforms on, and I saw my battle jacket, and I saw my pants. I saw my jacket. These guys were wearing all my clothes.
On three different guys?
Yeah. And so I said, well, you know, I want my clothes back. And so I said, you got any money? And yeah, they had plenty of money. So the hotel right next to the Lido Club, it's long gone. I said, I want a room, and let's go get me a room and at least give me a decent jacket or something, you know, something that shows that I'm not a GI. I went back to the squadron with them then, and I thought, I'm set. I got back there, and they'd just gotten this brand new P-38 J-25 with all of the modifications on it. They said, this is your airplane. And the flight surgeon, Doc Berg, who was a good friend, we're having dinner. He came up to the table, and he said, I don't like the way you're walking. So he said, we're going to go over to the hospital tomorrow morning. So I went over to the hospital with him, and I came out. I had a cast on from here the whole way down to my rear end. And I had apparently fractured something, and they said a fourth lumbar or something or other. Back to the hospital I go. Again, I go back through. I end up in England, got out again. Now, I guess I was determined. I'm back to the squadron. I'll go back and see if I'm fit to fly. And I got back to the squadron, and I was there for a couple of days, and they didn't offer me a new airplane this time. I got orders to go down to Paris. They said, you're going to get a Distinguished Service Cross. That's the last thing they said to me as I walked out the door. I said, what the hell's a Distinguished Service Cross? I didn't know. Anyway, that's the way it worked. I ended up down in Paris, and we had a great time with General Spots. And
Spots pinned it on you?
Spots pinned it on me. He was a good man. But it's like Leonard Scott when in England, after he came back from his sojourn with the pretty nurse, they gave out the Purple Heart. And so they gave me my Purple Heart and everything, and they gave Leonard a little acorn, and it was silver. He got his 7th Purple Heart when I got my first. So when I got my Distinguished Service Cross, Joe Myers was there, who became head of the Air Force, J.C. Myers, and everybody referred to him as Jesus Christ Myers. He got his 2nd Distinguished Service Cross. So you're always one behind somewhere.
Well, you're ahead of most everybody. And is it true that somebody told you at some point that you'd never fly again?
Well, that's really how I got home, I guess. They told me that I wouldn't, that second time back, they said, just quit coming back. You're not going to fly again. And Doc Berg said, I just put my foot down, you're not going to fly here. So when I went home, I packed all my stuff and got it back from all my friends, whatever they had of mine. I had all my records. As an officer, you carried your own records. Well, I put my medical records in the bottom of my B4 bag. When I got home, they stayed there, and I went through the depot down. It was the hotel in Santa Monica. So I just took a physical and passed it. So now I'm back on flying duty, and my records are still over in my footlocker in the hangar across the way.
And as a result, you got to be a test pilot, and I know we don't have time to talk about all of it, but were there some highlights or thrills of your time as a test pilot?
Well, yeah, I was up at Portland, Oregon, and we were a sub-depot, and we were a fighter. Portland was noted for being a fighter, what we call an RTU for fighters, and so I became a test pilot because Colonel Mon says, you're a test pilot. So I got to fly everything. I flew L-5s, I flew Stearmans, I flew B-25s, B-26s. I flew both the B-24 and the B-17 and never flew in the right seat. Always was lucky. I got to fly everything, and we had our moments. I remember going down the Columbia River with one feathered on the B-24, one feathered, one running away, and two working pretty well, and trying to make up my mind whether we were going to go over that interstate bridge on the Columbia River or go under it. And we did go over it, but it was close. We had our moments, and it was all good flying. Yeah, I had a Mustang. The only time I ever had lost an engine in an airplane was on a Mustang. We got the P-51Hs up there, and we were going to take them to Japan. Everything was shooting towards the invasion of Japan. And so we would have taken a group of 51Hs out of Portland. So I had an H quit on me on takeoff. I just enjoyed flying. I loved flying the B-24. I didn't get a whole lot of time in them. I just got test time. And the 17 was just like an old boat to me. It was just a great adventure. You got to fly everything you wanted. And you get in trouble once in a while for flying something you shouldn't have flown. But they were always, you know, if you're a test pilot, you get to fly them.
Including the first couple jets, right?
I flew the 59, the 80, and the 84. And I ran the first dive bombing tests on the 84. And that got to be a big adventure. We lost a number of people flying the early jets. The 80 was a good airplane, but we had the problems with it. We had stabilizers failing and people trying to bail out. And when you pulled that canopy of emergency, damn canopy had dipped down and knocked you out and you couldn't get out of the airplane. Then engines would, you know, cut your tail off, and you had those all kinds of things they designed into them. I ran the first dive bombing tests on the 84. I had to run the 300, 400, 500, and 600 mile an hour indicated release. And on the 600, it was typical of a test program. Everybody's in a big hurry and they're all pushing it. They had the test range was at the cold weather hangar, which I don't know if you've ever familiar with it, but it's the big hangar at Eglin. It was built in 1946. And they can take the temperature down to below zero, 40 and 50 degrees below zero, or they can raise the thing, or they put the static airplane in there and test it for cold weather operations. I'm going to run this first test, which is, you know, trying to hold a jet coming down from 10,000 feet at 300 miles an hour is like impossible, but you do the best you can. So we walked the range, and they had the cold weather hangar set up, and they had this false wall in it, so they could actually put a plane on jacks and fly a full mission on it in that hangar without it ever moving. They could fire the guns out. It went down through a canvas thing and down the range, but they wanted to use the range for this first 300 mile an hour test. So I walked the range with them, and they had some markers, and I picked out the marker. I picked out my aim point. There was a truck parked back away from the hangar, and so I thought, well, I'll just use this as a starting point on my pull through on the bombing. And by that time I was getting pretty proficient at dive bombing. I took off, and there were towers after me. Can you hurry up? Can you get up to 12,000 feet and you pull? We'll give you 28 seconds to do something. So I get up there and I roll over and I pick out my target, and I pick out the target that I had picked out on the ground. I picked up the truck and I come screaming down at 300 miles an hour trying to slow it up the whole way, and release the bomb, no problem. Make my break, come in, land. I hadn't been in the air more than 20 minutes and taxied in, and God, everybody's all up and all excited. I almost bombed the cold weather hangar. So I said, what in the hell do you mean? They said, well, look how close you were to it. And so I got down there, and I'll be a son of a gun. I had picked out markers that I was using as a target. I picked out the truck. Somebody moved that truck. And so I'm about two markers short and awful close to that hangar. My comment was, did I hit the target? Yes. Well, then what the hell are you worrying about?
I think by now you're probably getting an idea of just how much fun it'll be to meet Jim Kunkel at the Central Coast Air Fest next month in Santa Maria, California. Again, all that information is online, but you wouldn't have the chance of celebrating his 100th birthday with him there if he did not survive the next test in that primitive jet he was serving as a test pilot in. And we'll hear that chapter of this remarkable pilot story when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties, over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.